Hello and welcome to the show. My name's Ed Mann, and today we're very lucky to be joined by Vlad Koronov. How you doing, Vlad?
Hey, Ed. Thank you so much for inviting me.
No, thank you. Just for the audience, would you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, so I consider myself a software engineer that made a few bad decisions in my life. Those are writing books. One of them is learning domain-driven design, and the second one is balancing coupling software design. But I promise I'm not going to write any more books whatsoever.
Yeah, I've heard you say this. So before we kind of go into anything, I've heard you say like it's a hard experience writing the books and you don't want to. I will be one of these people saying, please rethink that. Your writing is amazing. And yeah, we really do want more. Obviously the pain, we don't want you to have to go through the pain. So if there is a lot of pain, I understand. But yeah, we definitely, I know there's a massive audience for what you do. So we really do appreciate it.
Well, let's see.
I know, this is the thing, isn't it? It's that whole, I don't know, I'm a marathon, so it's like when we run a marathon, you're like, oh, I'll never do that again. And then a month comes and you're like, well, it wasn't as bad. So maybe, I don't know, maybe writing a book is a very similar thing. I'm not sure.
Yeah, my examples are a bit more grounded. It's like, I'm not drinking anymore. And you know, what happens later, a week later.
Oh dear. So what motivated you to write the Learning and Domain-Driven Design book? And also, how does it differ then to the red and blue books?
Yeah, so the story of this book began a few years before that. I was working at a company and I had to figure out a way to introduce this concept of domain-driven design to quite a lot of people. So over the time, I fine-tuned my approach of explaining it, of, you know, what is the domain-driven design, why we need it, how you're going to apply this, and how we all can benefit from it in the company. And later on, I got an offer from O'Reilly to write a report about domain-driven design, which is like a really short book, which was supposed to be 40 pages, but it ended up being 88 because, yeah, I am very good at estimating. I'm a software engineer, part of the job. So, yeah, I wrote that book, little one, 88 pages, What is Domain-Driven Design? It was supposed to be something that you can read over a flight and get an understanding of the basic concepts. It's not going to prepare you, you know, to work, to implement those tactical patterns, for example, but it was supposed to give you just enough background information about it. Now, that report ended up being locked in O'Reilly online learning platform. That was the goal, but people wanted to read it. So I asked them, come on, let's put an animal on the cover and let's sell it as a book. And they told me, no, it's too short. We need to add at least 2 chapters. And I said, okay, awesome. So I'll write.
We know how much you like writing is by this point. So yeah, you were definitely up for that.
Exactly. So those 2 additional chapters turned out to be a stone soup because I had to rewrite the whole thing because the ideas changed, the goal of the book changed. And yeah, I had to do it from ground up. And that's how the monkey book came to life.
I love it, yeah, because we've got the red book, the blue book, and I heard in the YouTube meetup thing, it was like, yeah, calling it the monkey book. I was trying to work out what to call this. You know, we have to have a single word, you know, way to be able to distinguish this, and the monkey book's a great one.
Yeah, that's because the white book is taken. The modeling made functional. It's the white book of the
monkey. That's it, exactly, by Scott Voloshin. That's really cool. And so I'm just wondering, like, so did your thinking of DDD evolve as you wrote this? And like, and also, how has your thinking changed since it was published? It's been a couple of years now.
Yeah, a lot of things happened during these couple of years, right? And I'm talking about primarily one that starts with A and ends with I. So right now, I'm pitching the idea of doing a second edition of the book. I'll tell you that secret. So my understanding changed. Some things have evolved, not dramatically, but there are some nuances that need to be adjusted for this day and age. Now, to be more specific, I'll give you one example. The chapter about event storming, I used kind of, let's say, classical explanation of the steps in full event storming process, and it ends with bounded contexts. Today, I wouldn't call that bounded contexts. I would say that those are boundaries of potential subdomains, but not bounded contexts, because bounded contexts are a function of models and organizational structure. Models, of course, they present in one way or another in an event storming session, but organizational structure, not so much. And that can mislead people doing it. So that would be one example.
Very interesting. But yeah, how that's typically taught is through like up to and then being a bounded context, isn't it? So is that a slight change to like how the standard practice would be to be using that?
Yeah. Also, I would spend more time talking about subdomains, because I'm doing Q&A sessions for book clubs that are reading my book, and I tend to listen to people, what they're asking, their questions, and more often than not, subdomains get the most attention, and that's the hardest part of domain-driven design. Not bounded context, not ubiquitous language, not aggregates, events, or no, subdomains, that's the hardest part. And I will reveal another secret. There are a few ideas that I'm thinking about right now to put into that second edition. Maybe a different way to explain subdomains and a different way to define them. But I don't want to get into too much detail because that stuff can change.
Totally understandable, but very excited nonetheless. And actually quite a lot of my conversation and questioning I have around all this is around subdomains, bounded context, these two things, and certainly subdomains. But if we pull it back a little bit, just for the audience, like it'd be really good to know, like at its core, what is domain-driven design and what problem then is it trying to help solve?
Yeah, so when we are building software systems, we have a goal for those systems, why we are building them. And that goal is usually to serve a business. Now, what makes our jobs so hard as software engineers is that we, during our careers, we are working in different business domains. For example, medical system, financial systems, etc. And we cannot be doctors, we cannot be bankers, just because we need to build a system for that business domain. Still, we need to understand what's going on there, how that business works, and how that system is going to help that business to achieve its goals. And only once we have that understanding, we'll be able to make architectural decisions that will serve that business both in the short term and the long term. Domain-driven design helps us with exactly those parts. First, it provides a set of tools that help you to learn how business domain works, how to analyze it, how to identify its goals, its strategy, etc. Once you have that information, domain-driven design provides you a set of technical tools, how to implement that system in code, how to architect its a high-level architecture, and how to design its low-level business logic, all based on that knowledge and understanding of the business domain. So that's the goal of this methodology, to give you tools to gain that information and then to convert it into technical design decisions.
And so this would then be the split between the strategic and the tactical that you see when tactical and strategic DDD.
Yeah, so tactical DDD is the sexy stuff. That's the stuff that we all love, right? Writing code. Strategic DDD, on the other hand, is the important stuff.
Yep, the fluffy, important stuff that is not code. But as you say, and like subdomains is incredibly important. And really the most important thing is something that I've heard you say, and I totally agree with. The strategic is the most important thing from DDD that we can take out of it.
Yeah, exactly. So strategic DDD is all about gaining that knowledge, that understanding of the business domain, and converting it into, let's say, high-level architectural decisions. Like what are the large coarse-grained components of the system are going to be, how to assign the work on those components to different teams, how they are going to communicate, what are the challenges between those teams that need to be taken into account when designing how those components are going to interact, etc.
So with that, and we've kind of alluded to it there with the tactical and the sexy stuff, so, and I think this comes up a little bit, sadly, is like how much should, or a developer may think, is how much should a developer care about the, and I'll put in quotes, the business side of things? And a big misunderstanding is that surely we're just here to write code. Like that's what we got into the business for. Hey, someone's got a problem and we just want to write some code with it. Why should I care intrinsically about the business? Isn't that someone else's problem?
Yeah, look, if you were writing code that you write it once, it works and that's it. You celebrate it, that the project is successful and you continue to the next one in a different company. That would be one story. But of course, our life is a bit different. If you write code and it works, it achieves business goals, then this annoying thing happens in the future. You will have to change it, right? Now, when you're going to change it in a month or let's say a year from now, how easy is it going to be to change that piece of code? Is it going to be modular and you'll just need to modify only one module of that code base, or that code base is going to resist those changes? Of course, it depends how you're going to design it. Now, to design it with modularity in mind, you have to take into account reasonable changes that might happen in the future of that code base. Now, what are the reasonable changes? If you're writing a CRM system, let's say that in a year from now, we're going to refactor it into a driver for a printer. Is that a reasonable change? Probably not. But, you know, real life is a bit more subtle. You need a real understanding of the business to anticipate what is the crazy thing they're going to ask you to do next. And once you have that information, you will be able to design the code to architect that solution in a way that will be sort of ready for that change in the future.
Absolutely. And I think it's also the case that to get to that success where, you know, you said you wrote it once, it gets shipped. Well, did you write the right thing? Are you solving the real, you know, the actual problem? I think one thing that's misconstrued is like our value as developers to the business is not the code we write, but the problems we actually solve. It just so happens actually that a lot of the problems we solve are with code, which is great, but code is not the actual outcome. It's not the actual thing that we should be, you know, actually kind of striving for. I mean, obviously deleting code is better than actually writing more code in these cases, but solving the problems that they have is the key thing. And that's obviously where strategic DDD is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. First, you need to make sure you understand the problem. Only then you can start thinking how you're going to design the solution and then to implement it.
And so what then do you feel is the developer's role in surfacing like this business intent and this value?
Yeah, so as you said, the real value lies in the problems we're going to solve, right? Not the code, especially right now with that AI thing.
It's so true.
Yeah, and the problems we are solving with the code, they are important. Of course they are important, but we have that competitor, that AI thing that can do it as well. You can just write some prompt and it will produce some code that's going to be, let's say it's going to be sort of well-designed. It will solve that problem at the moment. But we have to think about future problems as well, because that's the long-term value of our work.
No, absolutely. And then kind of going back to DDD as like at its core, what are some of the biggest misconceptions you see people have with DDD?
So first one is DDD is about aggregates. And I've seen projects that are perfectly driven by the business domain and have zero aggregates in them. Subdomains and bounded contacts, that's a very annoying misconception that I've been battling for quite some time now. And the thing is, if you align their boundaries one-to-one, then you're losing all the flexibility that bounded contacts are supposed to give you. So you're losing that. And the most annoying misconception about domain-driven design is that it's hard, it's complex, and you don't really need it in, let's say, reasonable projects, whatever that word means here. And again, what I try to convey in my book is that, hey, domain-driven design is real simple. You have that way to analyze the business domain. You have that way to extract knowledge from domain experts. And then here's the decision tree, which is really simple to remember how to turn that into software design decisions. But still, I don't know, people are afraid of it.
And I think another thing with it is that, and this is the sexy code thing with aggregates and, you know, all these kind of things and domain models, is that it you know, that its core, it's not about building these types of systems, these domain models, these systems, it's about the actual business. And the output of this in the strategic, you know, design, DDD design, may not even be code. I think, you know, some of the things you've shown is kind of, you know, you've talked about is, you know, say someone is a jewelry. I think one of the examples was, and it's like, well, what's the core subdomain there? And it's actually, it's the jewelry. The website is actually a supporting thing. So you won't need to use these, you know, event source shiny domain models and all these types of thing patterns for it. An active record one is absolutely fine. And someone looking into this may go, well, hey, this isn't applying DDD in the case, strict sense of all of the, you know, tactical things that you can do, but actually they're applying it in the best way possible for them, and also getting as much value out of DDD as they can.
Yeah, exactly. Also, there are days where you spend most of the time in conversations with domain experts. You write zero lines of code. Maybe you even decide to delete a lot of lines of code, but still, at the end of the day, you get an insight into how the business works that suddenly aligns your understanding. Suddenly you understand how that business works, and how to design it in code, how to model it in code. And that's where, you know, the real value is.
And I think that that's so true. It's the real value's there, but maybe that's where the hardest part is that us as developers, us as quite, you know, an introverted group, I came into code programming to programming, quote, some, you know, people will say, not to solve problems and just, you know, at this higher level. It's like actually interacting with the business and trying to decipher that stuff is actually the hard part. And that's why people gravitate towards the tactical and towards the event sourcing and the domain models and all that fun, sexy stuff. Because it's actually the hardest part. And that may be why there is a lot of friction with it.
Yeah, and I totally get it. I was, I don't remember, 8 years old. I've heard that if I'm going to be a programmer, I will work with computers, not people.
Yep.
And they lied to me. That's the biggest lie of the previous century. Yeah, yeah. So, of course, let's be honest. Most of us are quite introverted. And that resulted, in my opinion, in quite a bit of issues, because if you look at studies that try to investigate why so many software projects fail, they give you tons of different reasons, but the common denominator in all of them is communication. One way or another, communication led to those issues, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, that's our job. You know, we have to learn to program not only code, but also our communication with people.
So true. So true. And so continuing on there with DDD, what is the business domain? So the domain in domain-driven design?
Yeah, that's you know, really hard question, because it wasn't really defined previously what is domain. So my understanding, and that's what I'm describing in my trainings, in the book, etc., is that domain is the business domain. That's the field that the company that's going to use the software system is working at. Or if that business domain of a company is too wide, then the business domain of a system. Like, what is the business goal of that system? Or its users, what is the functionality that has to be implemented by that system, etc. A really, you know, high-level stuff about, you know, what you're working on.
Yeah, and I really like how you kind of expand upon this, and I use this a lot now in my thinking, is business domain driven software design. And I think that really helps. And I think, yeah, adding business domain and then software design on it, it just adds a lot more understanding to this about where we are with it. You know, domain, what is it? Is it a web domain? Like, what is it? What is a domain? You know, and I think this is the thing. It's about business. And that's the key thing around this. Absolutely. Something here also is, so a business, you know, can a business have multiple domains? Can a company have multiple domains that they're in?
Yeah, of course. We have an example of Amazon. They have retail, they have cloud infrastructure. And business domain is not static. It can change over time. Company can decide, hey, we'll try that. It doesn't work. Let's try something else. And you know what? You mentioned those internet domains. And if you look it up on Stack Overflow, there is a question about domain registration on GoDaddy. And it has a tag, domain-driven design.
Oh, amazing. That is one way of getting the SEO and trying to, you know, like people go in. So you look for DDD and you end up buying a domain is how they're working with that.
Yeah, yeah. That's how I'm working on my hobby projects. I buy a domain and that's it. And that's where my design ends.
Well, you have the intent, you know, it's starting up. You've got to lock it in so no one else can take that name. And then, as you say, yeah, it's the hard part of actually completing it and getting it through. Oh, dear. So, yeah, we've talked about business domains there, and we've also alluded to subdomains. So this is the big one. What are subdomains and how do they help garner clarity within like the given business domain?
Yeah, so business domain is quite an abstract term. Like, okay, I work in retail. That's the business of the company I'm working at, and that's it. How is it going to help me to design software? Well, not really. It's not really going to help you. You need a bit, you know, deeper understanding of how your company is aiming to compete with other companies in the same business domain, with other competitors, other players in the same field. And to understand that, you have to identify those subdomains, the subdomains that the business domain is composed of. So we can look at subdomains as sort of business building blocks. Now, that's a very, very abstract way of explaining it. And that's the problem with that idea of subdomains. So let's try to be a bit more technical. We can say that a subdomain is a set of interrelated use cases. Use cases that are very likely to change together. So we can group them into that collection that we'll call a subdomain. Of course, they all are going to be related to some particular area of that business domain, say finance, say billing, or management of something. Now, although that technical explanation is, in my opinion, it's the most precise one, it still doesn't answer the question of granularity. What is the size of a subdomain we should be looking for? And that's the hardest part about this concept of subdomains. Now, if you're familiar with more business-oriented way of analyzing business domains, then you probably have heard about business capabilities. A business capability is something that is quite similar to subdomains. However, that model is hierarchical. You can look at a subdomain, at a business capability, and then you can look at a lower level and see finer business capabilities that it is composed of. That's not the case of subdomains. Subdomains are flat. There is no structure. So we have to work with that definition at the moment. And the question is, what is the level of granularity of a subdomain? There is no right answer here. The only right answer is the one that provides you value. How do you gain value from subdomains is by identifying the type of subdomain you are looking at. There are three types: core, generic, and supporting. In a few words, a core subdomain is an interesting problem to solve. That's how your company aims to compete with other players in the field. Something that is unique to your company, something that you're doing better. So that's an interesting problem. Generic subdomains are solved problems. Here we have functionalities that are implemented in the same way by your company and its competitors, and nobody cares. There is no competitive advantage there. So what are those solutions for these problems? Open source projects, off-the-shelf products, something as a service that you can just use, etc. So generic subdomains are solved problems. And then we have supporting subdomains somewhere in the middle. I call them the boring problems.
Yeah, you're allowed to call it on that in the podcast. I know you weren't in the O'Reilly book.
Yeah, I couldn't. They didn't like that. Yeah, the boring problem. So this is something that your company would love to be a generic subdomain, for there to be a generic solution, but there isn't one, so you have to do it. It's boring. There is no business differentiation here. Nobody cares about it. So you have those three types. Now, let's say you're looking at a potential subdomain. You have to think about how you're going to label it. Is it core, generic, or support? Let's say it's going to be core. The next question is about the granularity. Is the level of granularity is correct, or should you divide it into finer grained subdomains? And the thing is, you should try doing that. Try to decompose it further into finer grained groups of related, interrelated use cases. Some of them are going to be more interrelated than others. So try to decompose them further and see if those smaller potential subdomains have different types. Maybe one of them is going to be a supporting one or a generic one. If that's the case, that's valuable. Use that. You will need it when making software design decisions. If, on the other hand, you reach that level on which all of them just repeat the same type, then you can stay on that level of granularity where you are at right now. So, yeah, I've been speaking for a few minutes now trying to explain that notion of subdomains, but yeah, that's the hardest part of domain-driven design.
It's the bit that's got me, completely, like, over the years of applying and doing DDD bits and pieces, is the subdomains and bounded contexts and the interrelation between them, the understanding of the different types, as you say, and something that's very important around, and you've mentioned it there, with the analysis and kind of the investigative nature of this, is that you are discovering these subdomains from the current business. You're not building them or contriving them. And I think that's the hard part, because when you're saying breaking these things up, you're breaking up, or you're kind of putting a magnifying glass on what's already there. You're not contriving an example. You're not trying to do a solution-based thing there with, your bounded context. You are just putting a magnifying glass to what's there already. and the idea of usefulness. Because yes, you could put a magnifying glass to everything. But then again, this is the thing about a model. Every model's wrong, but they, you know, some are useful. And it's the same thing here, where it's like, how much do I put a magnifying glass onto certain parts and kind of expand into them?
Yeah, exactly. You know what? Subdomains, in my opinion, that's the one of the most important parts of domain-driven design. Of course, bounded contexts get all the attention.
Well, we start going to solution space. This is the thing, isn't it? It goes into the more sexy. It's the slowly into the bit that, you know, us as developers, we like programming. I love programming. So I'm going to have an affinity to solve a problem with code because I love programming. Do I love the problem that I'm solving as much as I love the programming that I'm doing to solve it?
Yeah, but you know what? I have to mention another issue with subdomains. So when I'm explaining these topics, I always say, as you said, that subdomains are identified. That's something that is out there, and bounded contexts are designed. We'll talk about them later on, but for now, let's talk about subdomains. So we identify them. They're already there. And that's 100% correct if you are working for a company that has a business that already exists, and you are just adding a new software system to that business. If, on the other hand, you are working at a startup company, then it's suddenly not really, you know, that's not true in all the cases. Sometimes, you know, as you identify those subdomains, you may identify something that is missing in the business. Or maybe you identify a misunderstanding of the whole business by domain experts themselves. And that observation is going to change the business domain and the subdomains. So that's something that we have to remember, because again, domain-driven design, the original blue book was written quite a few years ago, 20 years ago, or something like that. Back then, it was all about digital transformation, but right now the world has changed a bit. So we have to put that into perspective. Sometimes when we are looking at a business with that magnifying glass, we identify issues in that business, and that is going to change that. Still, our goal is not to make those decisions about subdomains ourselves, but, you know, to point domain experts, hey, here's an issue, fix it, and let them observe the outcome.
But then it's interesting as well, like thinking of it, and I kind of have a question forward, but I'll bring it forward, is that in a startup realm with using DDD, like you may be part of a very small team who's actually steering the direction of the company as well. And that's even more of a weirder hat to put on, because obviously, you know, you are starting to maybe think about the domain, you know, the subdomains that you're going to be putting in, you know, the core and all these types of things and discussions around that. And as you say, I'm very focused on, yeah, put a magnifying glass towards that. But you actually have both the creation and the kind of, you know, discovery of them in one place there.
Yeah, well, if you are in one person startup company, then of course, you are in charge of both. You have to wear both hats, business and technical one. But let's say that in your startup company, you have people like people who are in charge of the product. Then you have to work with them. Again, that annoying thing of working with people. Yeah.
Communication. Horrible stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have to, you know, that learning becomes two-way. If in, you know, old-fashioned company, the learning is going one way from domain experts to us software engineers, sometimes we identify those blind spots in their understanding, and we let them learn about, you know, what we found. But at a startup company, that two-way communication is so frequent, because especially if you are building a technical product, well, yeah, you will do stuff, you will observe the outcome, and you will have to notify, hey, our product has to be affected, has to be changed because of ABCD. But yeah, it's important to take that business perspective into account that, hey, now I'm changing the solution, but now I'm affecting the problem that we are solving. That can be in form of conversation with product people, or maybe, you know, if you're a one-man show, then you're doing it yourself. But still, you have to identify those cases where the problem is being changed, because the implications of a change in the problem itself are so big on the solution.
That's really interesting. And something on your blog quite recently that you've referenced is the QNevin framework.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, like, how does this help, how does this influence, how teams identify and then prioritize subdomains?
So if you're looking at the Kinevan framework, it's pronounced as if you're saying Kevin and you sneeze in the middle. That's how Dan North explains it. It's a Welsh word for terrain. It's a model decision support framework that helps you to make decisions in different situations. So if you want to make a decision or if you want to make a change and you know what's going to happen, then you're in a domain that's called clear. You have that understanding. You can just make the decision or make the change. If you don't know, but there is something, someone who does know, and you can ask them, then you're in domain that's called complicated. It's not clear, but someone can uncomplicate it for you, so you can get help from outside. Then if there is no expert that can help you, you are left with only one option is, and that's trial and error. You try things, you're conducting experiments. They have to be safe, safe experiments. You observe the outcomes, you identify patterns in the behavior, and then you make the decision. There is also a chaotic domain where there is no relationship between action and its outcome, where the same action can lead to different outcomes, or maybe it will lead to the same outcome, but you cannot conduct an experiment to identify those patterns. And we know that situation where the production is down, you know. We have no time for experiments. Production is down, we have to do something. That's the chaotic domain. But let's focus on the first three. So clear domain, the one in which you know exactly what's going to happen. That sounds like a supporting subdomain. In supporting subdomains, the business functionality is usually simple because there is no business differentiation there. Usually those are CRUD data entry screens, ETL jobs, etc. That's the clear domain, supporting subdomains. Now, complicated domain, something that you don't know how to implement, but someone knows. That's generic subdomains. You can get help from those external experts who implemented the solution in the past. Now, complexity, complex domains. That's the interesting part because let's say that you want to solve an interesting problem, something that wasn't solved before. Is it trivial to implement that solution? Well, if it were trivial, somebody would have already done it, right? So it's not going to be trivial. It's not going to be easy. You will have to try different solutions to find the optimal one. And that's where the similarity to core subdomains comes in. A lot of uncertainty in core subdomains, a lot of changes, because, well, not only the solution you're going to implement might change, but also the problem you're trying to solve might change because you might, maybe you are not understanding what your users, what your users want, like what is important for them, and you will discover it like half a year into your startup, it can change. So yeah, that's the parallel to core subdomains. Complex domains in Kinevan.
That's awesome, yeah. And I think, you know, you kind of alluded to it there as well. It's like the core subdomains, as you say, are the complex or the interesting problems, and they are the business differentiator. The idea is, you know, that if, yeah, you can write these or you can easily, these are trivial things that kind of have the esque of like a supporting subdomain kind of feel, then they're not a business differentiator. Some other business may come along and kind of, yeah, you know, easily take that up. So that's why, yeah, it was so important in the core domains. And so with this now, so we've got the domain, the subdomains, and I think probably one of the most important thing around domain-driven design, and the thing that I've taken and I've been able to take to a lot of different areas is the Udabiquis language. And I'm just wondering for you, like, what is the Udabiquis language, and what does it look like when it's working well?
Yeah, Udabiquis language. This practice from domain-driven design methodology relates to that annoying thing of communicating with other people. And it says crazy thing, like really, really unexpected, counterintuitive thing. If you want to communicate with someone, you want to understand each other, speak the same language. But, you know, as they say, common sense is not that common, especially when it gets to communicating with other people. So that's the idea. Now, the problem that this solution aims to solve is how do we get the knowledge about the business domain from business domain experts? And usually, business domain experts are not software engineers. They're not going to understand our technical language of databases, message buses.
Yeah, I'm going to insert a row in here and it's going to update this procedure here. And so, yeah, this completely is pointless to them.
Yeah, exactly. but they do speak the language of the business. Now, Kevin's in Domain Driven Design says, hey, speak with domain experts in their own language, in the language of the business. Now, once you will be able to communicate using those business terms, you will have that mental model in your head of how that business works. That language is the model that you will later use to make design decisions. Now, the problem with it is, you know, it's really hard for us. It's hard for us to forget about our technical lingo. I think, you know, business domain experts that were trained already to use technical terms, which is sad. And if you encounter that in a company, then, well, you have to be patient because it is going to take a lot of time to change that. Because once a language is being used, it's going to stuck there for a few years. Yeah, so that's the idea of ubiquitous language. Speak with business domain experts about the business domain in the language of that business domain. Try to understand what are the business terms are, what they mean, how they're related to each other, and build that mental model of how that thing works. That's the idea of ubiquitous language.
That's cool. And then, yeah, the ubiquitous language is all around context. And this is something as human beings we're quite good at, is being able to quickly switch between context or understand where you're meaning and applying certain things, such as domain. When I talk about a domain, domain-driven design, I'm talking about a business domain. Whereas if I was talking, me and you were registering on GoDaddy now, you'd understand the context change for me talking about a web domain. So this kind of aligns very well to talk now about what is a bounded context. And how do you design these effectively?
Yeah, the notion of ubiquitous language, that idea sounds simple. However, Eric Evans says that, hey, in order for ubiquitous language to work, it has to ensure that all of its terms have one and only one meaning. You should avoid cases where one word, one term, has multiple meanings. Now, that's not how people work. Take the word, as you said, domain, and it means quite a few different things to different people, right? And we cannot avoid that. Now, should we add a prefix whenever we are saying domain? It's like internet domain or software design domain or business domain, etc. Well, technically you can, but it is not going to make your communication effective. And at some point of time, people will forget about it.
Yeah, and you're forcing your language on their ubiquitous language that they're already talking. You're imposing yourself on them to say, no, you're wrong for talking in this way, which is just, as you say, not right.
Yeah, exactly. So to overcome that challenge, again, Eric Evans proposed an idea. Instead of trying to build one huge model, one huge ubiquitous language that covers the whole business, now let's do something simpler. Let's decompose it into multiple finer-grained languages and assign the context in which each language can be used. For example, you will have one set of terms when communicating with, let's say, creative people in your company. And another one is going to be used when communicating with, let's say, I don't know, BI people in your company. So you will identify business contexts in which different models of that business domain are being used. Now, these different models can reflect, you know, different terminology for same things, for the same underlying concepts that you may want to persist in the same table, but still, those domain experts in the company are using different terminology to describe them. On the one hand, our natural tendency is to say, hey, no, let me teach you about that business domain. Let me explain you.
Let me explain your job to you.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is, as, again, no, don't do that. Instead, use that. Use that to decompose your model, your language, into finer grade languages, assign the context. Make sure that you have that context whenever I'm talking with that group of people. I'm using ubiquitous language A and ubiquitous language B when I'm talking with that second group of people, or maybe multiple groups of people. And as I said initially, ubiquitous language reflects your mental model of the business domain. Once you have multiple languages, that means you have multiple mental models of that business domain. The next step is going to be to implement that functionality that uses that language, that mental model, the code base. And that's where bounded contexts step in. Bounded context is simply an area in your solution in which a certain model is being used. It's a models bounded context, or a ubiquitous languages bounded context. A context with, you know, a strong boundary. That ubiquitous language shouldn't leak outside of its boundary, or the models that are being used there should not leak outside of that boundary.
And when you say model there, it's something obviously that will come up in very implementation detail is models in domain models as in code models. Do you mean this, or do you also mean just models as a higher conceptual concern, you know, around like invariance and, you know, business rules and things around that?
So in this bounded context, when I'm using the word model, here's
model is actually a great one for ubiquitous language. There is so many ways you can say model and apply it to many different things.
Yeah. So again, our job is so hard because we work in different business domains. We cannot become doctors, we cannot become lawyers or bankers, etc., you know, to build those systems. So instead, we have to learn just enough information about that business domain to implement the system that we need to work on. Now, that understanding of the business domain is a model. It's not a copy of the real world. It's not supposed to convey all the information available about some real-life system, that company, for example, but it's a human-made construct that provides just enough information to be useful for solving a specific problem.
And can this be tangible, like an actual physical thing, such as like a map, but also a mental model, just the way I think of things?
So it is a mental model. Now, how can you make it? How can you represent it physically? I don't know. It's a mental model. It's something that you have in your head, and you can describe the terminology in documentation, etc. But that provides some challenges, because if something changes, you have to make sure that it's going to be updated. And if you have the documentation, that's awesome. Whenever a new person joins the company, they can read it and understand what you mean by policy. What is a model in that bounded context, etc.? They have that information, but the maintenance of such a document takes a lot of effort.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where we say, read the code. The code is the documentation, this kind of thing, because this is the thing that actually is the life and blood and actually is the source of truth. So I think with that then, I've kind of alluded to it as well, is like I found there to be a large amount of confusion between subdomains and bounded contexts in conversations I've had and also in my personal experience. So I'd love to go through like almost like a myth-busting exercise. I think we've kind of touched upon some before already. And there may be a couple of silly ones in there from me personally around kind of like playing with thought experiments on these things. But the first, and we've touched on it a little bit, is the confusion around how large, similar to microservice, because you put, you know, micro, how small, you know, how small is a microservice, but how large is a subdomain and a bounded context? And I think something that you've spoken about before, and this has helped me a lot, and it may help the audience, is around global versus local complexity. That's really helped to click it.
Yeah, so bounded contexts are there to protect the consistency, the integrity of the ubiquitous language that is being used in its boundary. Now, how we are going to protect it? We are going to protect it by using a physical boundary for the code base that implements that model, which means it's going to be implemented in a separate repository, etc. Something that makes it as hard as possible to introduce concepts from a different model, something that is not related. Now, the question is how it maps to subdomains. And again, there is, unfortunately, still is this misconception about one-to-one relationship between subdomains and bounded contexts. Unfortunately, things that sound easy, way too easy, are usually wrong. And that applies to designing your bounded context as well.
Well, I think we're in there because, you know, subdomain being a problem space thing and then bounded context being a solution, it's like, here's the problem. Oh, here's the solution to that problem. And it kind of feels beautiful, this yin and yang of like, hey, we have payments to subdomain. Okay, here's our payments bounded context and then the service for that. I think that's something, you know, that's it's quite hard to kind of break. I know that you've spoken about in the past around how, you know, you used to strive, or at least it was kind of common to see a one-to-one mapping. I think something that's hard for people maybe to grasp is the idea that how fluid bounded contexts and subdomains can be. You know, a subdomain can have been composed of many bounded contexts, and likewise, bounded contexts can be composed of many subdomains. Case in point, the biggest one with that is a monolith. A monolith is one big bounded context where it can have multiple different subdomains. And then obviously in a similar way with sub-bounded, you have modular monoliths as well. So I'm just wondering, yeah, like how do you shape, like how do we shape or move away? I mean, is it an anti-pattern to be one-to-one? What's your kind of thinking there?
Yeah, so look, changing the behavior is hard. What I'm trying to do is to raise the awareness for those situations where you will gain more value by designing wider bounded contexts that encompass multiple subdomains, or vice versa, situations in which the same subdomain have to be reflected in multiple bounded contexts. Now, again, the goal of a bounded context is to protect integrity of the ubiquitous language. Now, that ubiquitous language can be used to describe multiple subdomains of the business, which makes it possible, you know, to put them into one bounded context and implement them in the same code base. Now, that kind of goes against that fashion of microservices and micro, but thankfully we are past that already. So I'm not going to be stoned to death by saying saying that sometimes you gain much more value by designing wider bounded contexts, wider code bases. Why is that? Because let's go back to subdomains. Generic subdomains are boring. Sorry, they are solved. Supporting subdomains are boring. Nobody cares about them, right? But core subdomains, they are so interesting. There is so much uncertainty there. There are so many experiments you have to make in order to pick the right solution to the right problem, right? So there will be lots of changes in them. Now, let's say you are a startup company. And yeah, I bet unless you have some brilliant idea that I don't know how you managed to think about it, but you will have to make changes to your business strategy and how you are implementing it, which means there will be lots and lots of changes in those core subdomains. Let's say that you have two core subdomains and you can put them in a single bounded context. Let's say single service. In that case, whenever there is a change that modifies the boundary, something that goes across the boundaries of those subdomains, how they are integrated, well, that change is going to be easy for you because that's one code base. If, on the other hand, you decompose it into two services, then suddenly, you know, changing the boundaries of services, it's something that we say that we will refactor later. That's the future refactoring sprint. We'll do it for sure. But right now, let's put some hacky solution that just works and build. And
Nothing more permanent than a temporary solution.
Yeah. And then we'll build that big ball of mud from there. So a wide bounded context makes your solution more flexible. It's easier to make changes in the boundaries of, I don't want to say boundaries of subdomains, but let's say boundaries of the modules within that bounded context. Now, let's go the other way around. What about one subdomain being reflected in multiple bounded contexts? Now, people who are not familiar with the ideas of domain-driven design might say that this is heresy. It makes no sense. Why would you want to do that, right? Well, here's the thing. Let's say that you're working on subdomain for, I'm using it in the book, I'll use it here as well, for managing advertising campaigns, and you are a campaign manager. The way you are looking at that information, the way you think about it, the way you represent it in your head is very different from the mental model used by people from the analysis department. They are looking at the same set of data, but they are interested in different, sorry for saying technical term, but they are interested in different properties, different fields of those real life concepts. They have different mental models. So to leverage that core idea of domain-driven design, that we should not force mental models into domain experts' head, we have to represent that subdomain in multiple bounded contexts. That makes total sense if you want to achieve one of those core ideas of domain-driven design. If you limit yourself to one-to-one mapping, then guess what? You cannot do it.
And I guess in that case, then, you would then devise some form of subdomain, in quotes, that then aligns you to have another bounded context. You know, say you have this space where you've got your subdomain and you're like, oh, we need to do analytics on this and BI stuff. Okay, we now have a subdomain, which is our supporting subdomain called X, you know, for analytics or whatever. And then we have the bounded context, which loses its true thing where it doesn't really need to be its own subdomain.
Yeah, so eventually the solution is going to be quite similar, but it's going to be more complicated because that artificial subtlety is going to be introduced there. So that's, you know, a pet peeve of mine.
No, absolutely. And I think I struggle, you know, it's that hard thing of how coarse or fine-grained a subdomain, you know, that you're trying to identify can be. And again, when you're then trying to balance that with bounded context and in the solution space, it's part, you know, because part of me feels it's very pretty in some ways, where obviously the one-to-one is very pretty, but also for me also is another thing is that having a one subdomain and then multiple bounded contexts that, you know, are composed together to provide that subdomains, you know, to solve that problem space is quite beautiful as well. And so it's like, then I'm like, okay, well, I now need to identify or maybe zoom out and my subdomain's a bit larger because then I've got these multiple bounded contexts in. And I think that's the hard part for me is how much zooming in and out of the subdomains and, you know, the business itself that we kind of do. Because sometimes, yeah, we'll put a lens on that works quite well for our bounded context. And that feels like we're kind of crafting what we want or we're seeing what we want to see, but to kind of suit a solution space problem. You know, and that I struggle with sometimes.
Yeah, that's the hardest part of domain-driven design, again, subdomains. And that also affects how we should design bounded context as well. Because subdomains are so hard, because it's so easy to make a mistake there that you will need to fix in the future. You should make your life easier in the future. But making it easier to fix that mistake. Again, wider bounded contexts really, really help. Call it a monolith, call it modular monolith, design it well, put boundaries of modules that are going to be logical boundaries, change them in the future. Once you have, let's say, a more stable, a deeper understanding of that business domain, if you need to decompose them further, do it. By the way, I haven't mentioned that we should use the boundaries of bounded context for assigning the work on the system to different teams.
The ownership boundary.
Yeah, ownership boundary states that only one team should be in charge of one bounded context. Multiple bounded contexts can belong to the same team, but you should avoid situations in which multiple teams work on the same bounded context. Why? Because of knowledge exchange. It's more effective in a single team than in multiple teams. If there is no difference between a single team and multiple teams, then you have to rethink your team boundaries. And so it enforces that ownership boundary. Now, once it's there, in the future, maybe your company is probably it is going to grow. You're using domain-driven design, you're providing business value, business growth, your company is growing, you have more development teams. So in the future, well, suddenly, if you only have two monolithic bounded contexts, you cannot assign that work to three teams. So you have to decompose them. Again, in the future, do it. In the future, you will have a much better understanding of that business domain. You will be able to make a better decision about how to decompose it so that you won't have to change those boundaries of services in the future.
That's really cool. And I think something you touched upon there, so we're talking about the monolith and the modular monolith. And I think that's something that's so important with bounded context is like the bounded context is independent of the deployment of how you deploy these things. You know, the context of the runtime, the non-functional needs, like just scale, deploy cadence and risk around that. And I'm just wondering then, so several bounded contexts can live inside like one deployable unit. But in that case then, so say I've got a modular monolith, I don't have one bounded context there, I could have segregated by namespacing, multiple bounded contexts. And as long as I'm abiding by the rules, you know, keeping them, you know, talking about, we'll talk about in going forward, like context mapping around communication with these things, we're getting the benefits of in-process single deployments in certain cases, some of the, you know, the problems around having more services and stuff, but we're still able to have these different bounded contexts. And in turn, also then be able to go, you know what, pivot and say, hey, actually, we need to break this out into a separate service and, you know, deployment artifact going forward. I'm just wondering kind of what your thoughts are there around the monolith versus the modular monolith.
Yeah, so I've seen teams that implement multiple bounded contexts in the same physical boundary, let's say the same code base, and then they have some strong discipline about what they can and what they cannot do. But my preference is, you know, when I'm doing some late night refactoring, don't test my discipline. So my preference is if you can have one code base for one bounded context and that's it. Now, that one bounded context, I still call it, let's say, a modular monolith, because there might be multiple subdomains in it. That's why I would call it modular monolith. Now, that same bounded context might have multiple deployable units. Maybe there are going to be Lambda functions, containers, maybe there are going to be cron jobs, etc. Multiple deployable units within the same bounded context. Now, my rule of thumb is, if you are in that situation, that's great. That's not a problem. You have multiple deployable artifacts in the same bounded context. However, all of them have to be deployed, redeployed atomically. Either all of them or none of them. Why? Because maybe there is a change in the model that only one is going to be aware of, and then the other ones are going to be producing, you know, incorrect decisions. So if your bounded context has multiple deployable artifacts, make sure to deploy them together.
And following on from that, it is something that you talk a bit about in other conversations. Now, you've mentioned that encryption is like a solved complex problem and we'd be treated maybe as a generic subdomain. But I've always thought of encryption more as like an and this is maybe what my understanding of it is, like it's more of an implementation detail within a bounded context, maybe to like handle security needs. Since it's not something we're like typically discussed with the business, it feels very like fine-grained as a subdomain, like an implementation detail-y subdomain, but perhaps I'm missing something. I feel it's obviously a very tried true thing. It's like, yep, you know, it's a generic thing. It's an off the shelf. I'm not going to choose it. Similar to the web framework maybe that I'll use, Ruby on Rails or Laravel. I'm wondering, yeah, where I'm missing on the subdomain part there.
Yeah, you're not missing. That's a hello world example, something that quickly communicates all the fun of implementing it yourself and all the challenges that you're going to face if you decide to do it yourself, even if it sounds simple in the short term. If we're talking about more business-related examples of a generic subdomain, then of course we have identity and access. We have to manage our users, we have to manage their permissions, etc. Well, we can do it ourselves, or we can use an off-the-shelf product like Auth0 or something, or Cognito. That would be more of a business world example. Another one would be email campaigns. Again, something you can do yourself, but come on.
Like Salesforce, CRM kind of things as well, Zendesk. And I think, so talking, and this is maybe, again, my confusion with generic subdomains. It's how much code or how much modeling goes into that. So, you know, we're employing Salesforce, we're employing Stripe maybe for payments, where it's a tried-true thing with Zendesk. When I say it's a generic subdomain, how much work, is it very much like similar to a supporting in that the amount of code we should do, the patterns we should use, the architecture we use is very simple? Yeah, so it's, I was wondering, yeah, what's the kind of coding, the amount of work going into it? Or is the subdomain purely, hey, this is a CRM, it is Salesforce, but the subdomain could be we're integrating with Salesforce, but we've got integration, you know, project a bounded context within that subdomain to handle that within our architecture. Or within our cert system.
Yeah, so it takes us back to the discussion about models and how your domain experts in your company think about that business. That business functionality right now, let's say we're talking about that CRM module. It might be aligned with the model used at Salesforce, but usually it isn't. Usually there is a different set of terms that your domain experts are going to use. And now we're stepping into the territory of converting models still in the strategic part of domain-driven design. So let's say that you're integrating a third-party solution that implements the functionality that you need. However, the model that is being communicated by its interface differs from the one you're using. Domain-driven design provides a tool for that. It's called the anti-corruption layer. It's a pattern which simply means, hey, let's implement an adapter. On our input, we are going to get the model from that third-party solution, and we're going to transform it into the model that is being used by people in our company. Now, in some cases, it might make sense to treat those translations that you need to make in order to integrate that third-party solution as a supporting subdomain of its own. And why? Because I prefer, you know, to treat generic subdomains as someone else's problem.
Yeah, so in its entirety, it's someone else's problem. Yeah. Because that's something I've always kind of wrestled with, is like, we talk about auth and we talk about identity. Yeah, I agree. We're definitely going to use someone, you know, go on the shoulders of giants, but there's integration there. As you say, we don't want to corrupt our models with things. We also have different names for things. We just have to integrate with them in general, like just generally, even if we're going to conform to it and be a conformist, we still have to have integration. So you would say, yeah, it would be a separate subdomain, supporting subdomain that is working for that.
Yeah. And it might sound like artificial supporting subdomain, but that's the way I prefer to describe it, because it just, you know, makes more sense to people. We have that generic solution, that's its boundary, and that's their problem. Our problem is how we're getting that information from them, and how we're going to implement that integration, whether it's going to be an ETL job for batch processing, or it's going to be asynchronous or synchronous, etc. That's something that we have to decide on. That's our design decision. Again, not something that is really challenging to be a core subdomain, of course, something that is simple. And in some cases, by the way, that integration can be implemented by a generic subdomain as well. Apache NiFi can be used in some cases for transforming models, etc.
Hey all, that wraps up part one of our conversation on learning domain-driven design. We covered what DDD is for, why strategy comes first, subdomains and ubiquitous language, and how bounded contexts protect model integrity. In part two, we'll get practical with context mapping, event storming versus domain storytelling, aligning architectures and testing with your domain, team ownership and pragmatic adoption, and how AI fits in to all of this. Thanks for listening, and be sure to check out part two when it's published. Bye.